plead my case. No obvious. Send me into outer space. And my fingers, I'll be June with diamonds and gold. But that ain't gonna help me now. You think you're right, but you were wrong. You tried to take me.
Yeah, that's me digging my own song.
Someone has to.
Come on, John. Listen up a little bit. A little bit right here.
One day,
I have my own band. I'm going to be back.
You got to get Pink on the show. How cool would that be?
Pink! Trouble! I get that email all the time. Who is that? Who does that theme song?
That is Pink. Trouble. I'm your troublemaker here from 3 to 6. Sorry. 3 hours a day. Let's just say that. I'm Nancy Skinner, and the number is 866-991-9927. The number to the program. You know what? Let's try something before we get into all the nastiness and global meltdown and all the situation with me on TV and the automakers now, new developments in that world, the president abroad, mobs, scenes all over. Before we get into that, let's test out, I was told that we have a new 800 number. John, are you excited about that? We finally got our new 800 number working, so we can test it out. Both of them should work. I haven't really done it, but let's give it a jingle. Who wants to be the first person to call the new 800 number that I've been so desperately seeking for the Nancy Skinner Show? Because the other one was just hard to remember. This one was great. We had a listener to the program. Here's the backstory. Who loves the show and is in the business of 800 numbers, working on that, and I was. You know, I've been whining about not having a better eight, an easier number to remember. And so this nice gentleman, I'm going to have to get his name appropriately. I wasn't prepared. I just got a call saying your new 800 numbers should be working today. If it's not, we have the other one, but you'll know it. We'll go without the net. So the new 800 number, who's ready? Who wants to be the first caller on the new number? It's 1-888-64-NANCY. 1-888-64-NANCY is the new number to the program. So we'll see if that works. If that doesn't work, we still have 866-991-9927. And the 1-888-64-NANCY will be working tomorrow, if it's not working today. A lot of build up for that. Okay, then. I'm excited about that. Thank you to have that number. That's a lot easier. That just to say 1-888-64-NANCY or 64 against Nancy, I suppose. Some might say there was lots of that. You'll get a dose of that after being on the Bill O'Reilly Show. Oh my, last night. To be me, to go out on that show and then the reaction is something else, is the story in and of itself. And so we're going to talk about that because it really relates to what's going on today with the G20 meeting in London. The protesters breaking into the Royal Bank of Scotland. This is the guy who gets things done. You know, the guy on the TV commercials that's the calm one, the James Bond-looking guy. Everyone's in a panic or has all these smart ideas, and this guy gets things done. Isn't that sort of ironic? That I wonder what that guy is up to. Why isn't that guy on O'Reilly? Because they're not getting things done over there. But the whole world's kind of in flames. They broke into the bank yesterday downtown. Let's see, well, they're ahead of us several hours. Breaking into the heavily guarded Royal Bank of Scotland and smashing its windows. Earlier, they tried to storm the Bank of England, pelted with eggs and fruit. Huh, that's interesting. So I guess, wait a minute, our 800 number must be, 1-888-64-NANCY must be working. I saw a flurry of phone calls light up when that happened. Let's hope that, in fact, they did. Is this Matt?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Matt. Did you dial my new 800 number?
I dialed your new 800 number.
Yay! Okay, you're the first one on the line from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Matt. How are you?
Not so good. I have to take challenge to you. There's a lot of people out there that are pipe fitters and people that work in, like in Buffalo, we have a lot of jobs in the auto industry. And, all I see from Mr. Obama and people like yourself is wanting to destroy businesses that create good jobs for people like us. We build nuclear power plants. People like me or pipe fitters can make $48, $50 an hour, great jobs, but instead, I'm working for a small company putting furnaces in. You know, I should be working for a big company making great money, but things like nuclear power plants aren't being built. The auto industry is in shambles because we can't build big cars because we're afraid to drill for oil in our own country. People that I know that were in the oil industry, we're making great money, running pipelines, drilling oil, derricks and such, and those jobs are gone because liberals want to get rid of things like drilling for oil. For some reason, you guys think that the planet's going to explode. I'm not sure why you think that.
Wait, Matt, first of all, are you at the gym?
No.
You're walking or something.
I'm walking outdoors.
Okay. So, Matt, I don't think that we want to destroy jobs. I think that that's a little unfair, don't you think? I'm taking your statement at face value. Do you think, honestly, anybody who dedicates their life to this gets up and thinks, I want to destroy jobs? Because
Why are we not building nuclear power plants in this country? They work all over Europe. Why can't we build them here? I mean, I'd love to make $50 an hour.
Then let me answer that question, because if you're a pipe fitter, certainly you're in a union. You're in the pipe fitters union, a very powerful
union. My union, unfortunately, supported Barack Obama, and he's destroying our jobs.
Powerful union. Matt, you got to let me speak, okay? The idea, who was the president when all of these jobs were lost, okay? President Obama's been in office for 2 months. And he, let me tell you, you asked me a question. You said, why aren't we building? I'm trying to answer all of them, but let's start with the basic and work back before I get into this, because I'm used to dealing with it. Why don't we build nuclear power plants? I'll tell you why we don't build it. Because nuclear power plants cost about, the energy that comes from it is about 12 cents a kilowatt hour, and that does not include the decommissioning cost of a plant, which is anywhere from $2 to $3 billion to decommission a plant, never factored into it when anyone tries to estimate the cost of nuclear power. Not to mention, Matt, that we don't have a disposal site yet. That has been agreed upon, because Yucca has been in study for well over a decade, and there are fault lines there. So who really wants to have a repository of nuclear waste that has a half-life of tens of thousands of years over a fault line in the desert? No state wants it. Nevada doesn't want it. So we don't have a place to put it. Meanwhile, it's building up at all of these facilities, Illinois being the largest state that has the most utilities, nuclear power plants. They don't have anywhere to put this toxic waste. Why continue to invest in something to even build a plant, which is long term, which is by the time they even come online, it's going to be a decade down the road. It's the costliest form of energy that there is. Wind energy is about 3 cents a kilowatt hour, and there are so many advances that are being made. It's like going back to Fred Flintstone. Let's do that, Detroit. Instead of making a breakthrough in advanced technology vehicles, fuel cell vehicles and plug-in hybrids and whatever transition to get us there, let's go back to Fred Flintstone. And let's put rocks on our car and drive like that. It's ridiculous. It is not the energy of the future. It's the energy of the past, nuclear energy, with the risks that we have. Not to mention the fact that Iran is enriching uranium because they can, because then you're providing fissile material for the whole world. How about that, Matt? And then we have to go defend against that when you can have a clean solar hydrogen economy. Doesn't have those risks and doesn't have those costs. So you wanted me to answer your question. I mean, be careful what you ask for when you get me going. I might just answer it. 1-888-64-NANCY, I guess, is the number to the program. Yes, I was on Bill O'Reilly last night, and I'll share with you some of that and some of the reaction, some of the love that I felt after being on the Fox News Channel, Bill O'Reilly last night. 866-64-NANCY. Did anybody see it? Let me know. My friends out there, obviously Matt saw it, just doesn't agree with me. We have a difference of opinion, Matt and I. 866. No, 1-888, like all those eights, 64 Nancy on the Nancy Skinner Show. Well, all I know is you and I are meant to be.
there's someone you can't live without. Medusa. And if there's someone you can just shove out, we'll do so. You can be my Yoko Ono.
This I like. There you go,
you
John.
You're
a naked lady? Right, I'm for it. Is Nancy Skinner show? I'm Nancy Skinner. It was just pointed out to me we have our new 800 number. I'm all excited about 1-888-64-NANCY.
And that's N-A-N-C-Y, in case you're fancy and you spell it with an I. I'm a Y. I'm old-fashioned.
Someone else pointed out to me that in case you 64, that's kind of for me. If you're not for me, like some people for me or against me, it's also O-Nancy, 1-888. O-H-Nancy. That was just pointed out to me via email. So,
O-Nancy.
Isn't that funny? 1-888-O-Nancy. I didn't even realize that. Isn't life strange? So it could be, it's like the C-SPAN. You know, they have the, now calling on the Democrat line is, Bill from Wilshire, New Hampshire. Go ahead, Bill. You got the Democrat line, the Republican line, or the, yeah, and the in-between line, whatever you want. 1-888-64-NANCY. 1-888-OH-NANCY! Either one of those will work. All right, that's what Bill O'Reilly said last night. I know I get a lot of stuff for going on these shows, but listen, I'm not going to give you all his talking points. I did that. His whole thing last night was, war on terror and the fact that President Obama is now, when he's talking, they are not using that word war on terror, just across the board, scattershot, war on terror. We're at war with all terror. It's kind of more surgical, more targeted. So he set it up saying this was, he's off to a bad start. I must say that Bill O'Reilly said it was good that he was talking about cooperation with the rest of these countries, but it's a bad start to not use the war on terror. And isn't that stupid? Who are we worried about offending? Should we be offending somebody? That's how he phrased it. See, frameology. Here's how your own responded.
Well, Bill, the President Obama, he swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States. He did not swear to uphold the counterproductive rhetoric of the last administration. And I think that the idea of just those words, the war on terror, what happened is, he wants to go in there surgically, and actions speak louder than words. He would prefer to walk softly and carry a bigger stick. Deal with, you said Pakistan is the key to this whole situation. So when we start using words, fighting words, and start recruiting more people, then that makes our job harder.
So who's offended, Ms. Skinner, by the term
it's not about being
war
offensive.
On terror?
It's not about being offensive. It's a term of recruitment, and even a lot of military generals are saying... To get more terrorists
say the war on terror, then jihadists are going to sign up. But if we don't say it, they're not going to sign up. Are you trying to sell that to me?
I'm saying that when you just sort of you rumble like you want to, we're going to go rumble with you.
It's
you
a
bring
war.
It on,
what are you doing?
Said,
a war? You're fighting.
Well, it's a war on who? When you're talking about
it's
World
a war
II,
on
those
terrorists.
Were state governments. That was Germany in Japan. Those were states to say all just to sort of somehow blur the lines between Muslims and terrorists.
What blur? Could you say it's a war on
and
terror?
And makes our job harder.
You
it makes
be,
our job
you could be from
Bill.
Texas if you're a terrorist. We're going to find you. This is just insane. All right, let's Ms. Baxter, what is the most important thing?
Okay, there is a longer segment than that, and we had to come back. But that was it. And, you know, I think I got to tell you something. There's more than just me being on the show last night for a little segment. That was an audition for the O'Reilly Show last night, and I got a call this morning that they are going to have me on as a regular contributor to the O'Reilly Factor. So, it went, you know, it obviously went well, and I will now be a regular contributor to the Bill O'Reilly Factor on the Fox News Channel. So we look forward to seeing me on with Bill O more often. What do you think about that? 1-888-64-NANCY, regular contributor, me and Bill O'Reilly, going at it on a regular basis. Pretty cool, although a little scary. I'm not going to have time when I come back. I'm going to read you some of the love letters I got. from people, from viewers. I've, you know, got a lot of good response, obviously, being on there. But the war on terror being discarded as a term of use or substance in the war in Iraq, or the war just in general. And now we're talking Afghanistan, really. We're going to actually talk to an expert on phraseology as it concerns that and the war on terror and whether that was a useful phrase or not. I contended it was not, and look what it did. It got me a gig, a regular gig on Bill O'Reilly's show. What do you think about that? Any reaction? 1-888-64-NANCY, number of the program. And I'll have to figure out those numbers as well for y'all. Lots more to come on the Nancy Skinner program. I like this song because I think it's appropriate for all the love letters I get when I'm on, say, Bill O'Reilly or the Fox News Channel or on TV. So I thought I'd share a little bit of those with you on the Nancy Skinner Show. You can feel it, what I feel. This from, okay, let's see. Dear Nancy, we saw you on the O'Reilly Show last night, and every time you opened your mouth, we thought we never heard a woman as dumb as you. Mind you, we are in our 70s, and that is a long time to be hearing stupid women. Love, V. All right. Let's see. And now, another one. Here we go. Didn't work as well with my email box jamming me out. Another letter.
Love letter.
Dear Nancy, I saw you on the O'Reilly Show last night, and I was very unimpressed. You were very negative. The fact that you come from Detroit makes me think even worse of you. Detroit is the way it is, a mess and a drag on the whole state of Michigan because of Democrats and liberal policies that have taken place for the last 20 years. I don't want to sign up for your change, your real change. After Obama gets finished spending us into oblivion, I will be lucky to have any change in my pocket. You keep your change. I want my freedoms and capitalism, not socialism. You and Obama are creepy and like Big Brother. You want all of us to suffer. That is what Obama keeps saying. We all have to suffer. I found you disgusting, and you looked evil. That long hair looked terrible. Basically, you come off as nasty. Love, Connie. All right. We'll just have to do it. Have that. Be it. See, can I get a quick one in before?
You sound awful thin.
Let's see. One more. Oh, this one. Here we go. We'll end on this note. This one touched my soul. Made me cry, actually. Dear Nancy, saw you on Hannity last night. Doesn't even know what he's watching. You are the poster child for dumb blonde jokes. What a witch. Love, Ken. some of my love letters that you will get used to. I got lots of them last night. My friend Sharon, who also monitors, or the webmaster monitors that email, she called me aghast. Oh, my God. This is terrible. But I will tell you, I got some emails. The reason I do this is I got an email from someone in New York who not only said I was absolutely right, he's a lawyer, has an education. So glad that I was able to talk about the war on terror in realistic terms. Not only did so John wrote me, and what did he do? He wrote to the station. He said, I am so impressed with you. Been listening to your show, and I'm so impressed. I watched you on O'Reilly, and that he actually wrote the station in Los Angeles. He listens to KTLK. That's where he listens. And wrote them and said, this is an intelligent woman who is not afraid to take on the other side and have a debate and is willing to stand up for what she believes in, and she does it with grace and eloquence and said all these wonderful things and called the station and wrote the station, and I have a new listener, do you see? And now that person's going to reach out to a station, and that station's going to say, hey, that's good that somebody's able to go on a show like that, debate Bill O'Reilly, and get out there and get a lot of people to listen to me. Whether these people say they hate me or not, I guarantee they will be at least listening to the debate, and they will have someone challenging them on this notion that we have to continue. Like, here's a great example. War on terror. That was the big topic last night. The war on terror. President Obama, Secretary of State Clinton have not been using that word. And as I said in the last piece, if you didn't hear it, I said that he swore to uphold the Constitution, not the unproductive rhetoric of the last administration. And that is the consensus that, you know, just saying the war on terror, you know, terror, that didn't necessarily smoke him out of a hole. Well, guess what? He's still in his hole. Osama bin Laden is still in his hole. Many military people have concluded that the fact is that things like those words, the rhetoric, the bring him on, all those things did really just serve to be them's fighting words. And it served as a recruitment tool. That's what it is. When you just sort of have this vague war on terror, that really it adversely affected our national security interests. Okay? So I'm not afraid to go on Bill O'Reilly's show and say that. That's because that's the truth. A lot of people might be. I was not. But I certainly do pay the price when I do. Aye, aye, aye. 1-888-64-NANCY. Or if you're more comfortable. The status quo. 866-991-9927 works as well. Joining me now to talk about the war on terror and the next chapter on the war on terror is David Harris. He has written a piece for the San Francisco Gate entitled The Next Chapter in the War on Terror. Mr. Harris is an international journalist, author of many books, traveled throughout South America, Europe, Southeast Asia, the Middle East for the last 35 years, contributing editor at the New York Times Magazine, Rolling Stone, 10 nonfiction books in all, one novel, on a whole range of subjects. I thought this was interesting. David, first of all, thanks for joining the program.
Hey, my pleasure.
Your bio is pretty interesting. Your subjects are from Kurdish diaspora to football, to the history of broadcasting. Man, you and I would really have a lot to talk about. We could do some serious chai latte and talk.
Well, I hear you. I'm ready.
No, thanks for joining the show. And sorry about having to go through the Bill O'Reilly aftermath that I go through when I go on these shows. But there's something to be said about that, is there not, David, that the words... were the words the war on, in your view, I'm not going to ask a leading question, but was the word war on terror designed to have a powerful effect? The words, you know, war, they're loaded words. They're chosen deliberately. And I'm sure the last administration being the war president, I'm sure that they thought through the war on terror as a phrase itself.
Absolutely. Well, you know, they want the title itself to give them all the clearance they need to pursue the policies they wanted to pursue, including ones that abrogated the Constitution whenever they felt like it. So.
And so, war. When you use the word war, you essentially, you're opening that lane.
And the great mistake here is that they took it seriously, so that our strategy against terrorists amounts to our sending. Occupying armies halfway around the world and trying to maintain them in order to deny these people home bases. We have not succeeded in denying them a home base, and instead we have used up all our resources in a pointless effort. If we really want to stop terrorists, this is not the way to do it.
Well, and I mean, you can't deny that there wasn't indeed a war was fought in Afghanistan, that we were attacked by Osama bin Laden on 9/11 and 19 Saudi Arabians. And so we went to war with with should have we went to war in Afghanistan, and President Obama now is refocusing on that war. I mean, he was always focused on it. When I ran against him, I didn't mention that to you, David. A lot of people don't know that. So I was, during that whole debate about the war in Iraq, his answers consistently were, look, this is a distraction on the war against bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and that is centered in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And he said that this was all back during the U.S. Senate race, primary race. So when people, I am surprised now that he is president, that people are shocked that he is increasing troop levels and moving the focus from Iraq to Afghanistan, because that's what he has been saying he was going to do as a Senate candidate and as a presidential candidate. Now he's president and he's doing it. Is that surprising to you?
No. I follow the campaign closely. I certainly heard him say all that about Afghanistan. I was hoping that that was just political dressing that he would then revise in the face of realities. And unfortunately,
why is that? Why is that?
Why is it that I expect that? I hope that.
Yeah.
Because he was the best option we had.
No. I mean, to the issue of why not? I mean, because I agree with him that Afghanistan and Pakistan are the centers of where this particular strain of terrorism. It's not just the war. I don't like the word war on terror in general, because it's obtuse. I mean, what does that mean? The war on terror? Hey, Bill O'Reilly was using it to include the anarchists who are protesting the G20 meeting. He's saying they're terrorists. I mean, you could label anything bad terror, you know?
You know, certainly there is an identifiable group of that calls itself al-Qaeda that indeed attacked us on 9/11, and towards whom we have the right to seek them out and bring them to justice. I have no contention against that. But what we have done instead is simply expand this proposition far beyond any response to 9/11. It's yielded a six-year military occupation that is nothing but a drain on us and our resources.
But be specific. Are you talking about six-year? Are you talking about Iraq or Afghanistan?
I'm talking about Afghanistan here. I mean, Iraq is another case and is obvious idiocy, and we seem to have at least come to our senses around Iraq and recognize that we got to get our army out of there whenever we can get it out.
So, but you're looking now, David, though, through the rear view mirror of what was. And the fact was, if we had done this, if this could be a major do-over, a mulligan of cosmic proportions, and we went into Afghanistan really focused on capturing bin Laden, not letting him go in the mountains of Tora Bora and escape, giving up essentially on him, who knows what would have happened? We may have been able to have dealt with this situation in 2 years surgically and not have caused a sort of uproar among the whole Muslim world that a war against Iraq did, and not to mention the problems with Iran gaining power and everybody perceiving it as a missed target and anti-American sentiment. Just if you had to go back and redo it all over, it could have been completely different.
It could have been, and it should have been, but it wasn't. And the nature of what was happening in Afghanistan was transformed over those same 6 years. It was no longer us going in and making a punitive strike against al-Qaeda and bringing some people to justice. We lost that as a goal, and instead we adopted the goal that we were going to remake Afghanistan by occupying it with our troops and generating a new society there.
All right.
A task that is far beyond us.
Well, you know, when we come back, there's a break. David Harris, my guest, I'm going to ask you what it is. You know, what's the alternative, I guess, is the question on the table now. We are where we are. You can't go back and do it all over. There are no mulligans in war. And so that's the question. I will pose it on the other side, and you can jump into the conversation at 1-888-64-NANCY or 1-888-OH-NANCY. Whichever you prefer. I'm used to it from both sides, actually, these days. Just don't spell my name wrong. NANCY on the Nancy Skinner Program. go. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. Nancy Skinner here with you. 1-888-64-NANCY, 1-888-0-NANCY, or 1-866-991-9927. See, we've got multiple options here. As we do in terms of our choices of how we are going to secure the homeland. I don't like that President Obama used the homeland. He has ceased using the words war on terror, as was the subject of my little fight with Bill O'Reilly last night. And I'm talking to David Harris, who's written a provocative piece for the San Francisco Chronicle about the next chapter in the war on terror. David, at the break, I was asking you, we were talking about, just if you're just joining the show, he and I think, disagree a little bit about the fact that we need to be in Afghanistan, completely agree that Iraq was a complete waste and a distraction. You say in your article that our mistake was in taking the war on terror literally. We invested the great bulk of our resources in the occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq, thinking our battlefield dominance would deny our terrorist enemies a home base, even where they had none before our invasion. You talk about Pakistan now being their home base, and Pakistan being a critical ally to us, their own government, we can't find the right formula essentially to deal with Pakistan. And now I'm going to let you answer my question, which is, so it happened, you know, stuff happens, as Dick Cheney would say, with having to deal with Iraq and this neglected war in Afghanistan. What then do we do? What would you recommend President Obama do? Not try to correct the wrongs of the past?
No, certainly correct the wrongs of the past, but the question is how much of it you're going to correct. And the problem here is that the conception itself is a failure. The notion that military occupation is going to succeed in denying a home base to terrorists has been proven to be false. It's just not going to happen. We are not, going to pacify Afghanistan and Pakistan by sending troops there. No, if it's 21,000 more, or 42,000 more, or 84,000 more, we're not going to succeed in pacifying those countries.
Well, when you say pacifying, because I believe the approach is kind of it's both. It's diplomacy and being a lot more effective with our military resources. So, because they are extending a great deal of rebuilding and education and support for the Pakistani people, and that's being received quite favorably, actually.
And I'm all for it. I think that's certainly the direction our policy ought to go in, rather than assuming that the endless application of military force is going to do it. But we haven't. Acted more efficiently. Or we've increased the number of troops. If in fact our military strategy is going to be more efficient, why do we need more troops to do it?
Well, because it was undermanned to begin with, and they're not engaged in the same sort of battle that they were in Iraq. Certainly, I think this is more about targeting and presence and stability on the order, David, of Kosovo. In a way, I mean, I know that we're not trying to breach a peace between the groups as we did in the Balkans, but there is a sense that you can't just go in and just do diplomacy. There has to be we have to get bin Laden. I mean, you have to have a military effort to pursue those folks who attacked us and who are planning and plotting directly, and you're not going to be able to do that without a military. I guess
well,
this is a simple way to say
the
that.
Military, or even the possibility of military action. The question whether that should be an occupation, where we try and hold down the one country and advance into another. That's the question. Certainly, if we can identify the people that we set out to get and go get them, then that's great. But what we have done instead is expand the war far beyond what it was before, give our enemies far more standing than they had before, and allow them to make alliances that have only strengthened them. Our goal ought to be to split them off from their allies, and we're not going to do that by using military force the way we have been using it.
And we're not doing that. So I would contend that we do need a military, and we're not doing it like President. It's nothing like President Bush's military and his exercise.
Well, where is the evidence that this is? Different. It's not different in Afghanistan.
They've been there for 2 months now. I'm plumb out of time, David.
You know,
I'm, I'm up against my clock, David. I'm sorry. I gotta let you go. David Harris, thank you so much. It's that darn clock that I'm up against, but it is different. He's been in office for 2 months. You can't say it's the same thing after 2 months. I'm sorry. That is just, it's unfair. Give this man some time. And we'll continue our discussion on the Nancy Skinner Show. I forgot something. I forgot the good part. The whole last hour on the Nancy Skinner program. 1-888-64-NANCY or 1-888-0-NANCY, whichever you prefer. When I was on Bill O'Reilly last night, fighting and duking it out, played that for you and told you it was the audition thing that went over with me and Bill doing our regular gig together. I just forgot to mention.
Night Poofle.
There you go. Right?
Night Poofle.
That's what it, me and Bill O'Reilly every night?
Night Poofle.
No, of course not. I couldn't stand that. Not with the hate mail I got from being on just one night. How could I handle that every single night? All right, 1-888-64-NANCY. Speaking of hate mail, I bet there's a lot of hate mail going on right now with the G20 summit in full force. A lot of people are looking at now this is the first time that President Obama is essentially on the world stage. And the rest of the world his ratings are very high, despite a global economic meltdown. They feel as if there's some hope in this world that somebody is finally in control. One of the people who did not speak so fondly of, President Obama privately, according to Cy Hirsch of the New Yorker magazine, was, former Vice President Dick Cheney. Cy Hirsch reports that Cheney portrayed Obama, this is to someone in private, someone related this. This is in his reporting. So this was in the April 6th issue of the New Yorker, that Cheney portrayed Obama to the Israelis as a pro-Palestinian who would not support their efforts, and in private disparaged Obama, referring to him at one point as someone who would never make it in the major leagues. And then, Cliff May, I got Cliff May on the line. He's going to join us. He was on Hardball talking about it. Let's see if you can.
Major leagues. It's former Vice President Cheney out of line in the protocol here. Joining me are Joe Connison, national correspondent for the New York Observer.
Oh, nope. That's not working. All right. I got a bad cut that's going there. All right. So we're not going to do that. There we go. Sorry, it didn't work. My sound card just failed on me that I shouted out over. But, oh, what the heck? I got Cliff May, the president of the Defense of Democracies himself, on the line. So I will let Cliff May. I was going to give that little dust up with you and Joe Connison on Hardball, but you're here to dust up with me. So thanks for coming on the show, Cliff.
Good to be with you, Nancy.
So what do you make of that? I mean, you know, let's just talk generally about Dick Cheney and his comments about this administration. President Bush seems to be playing it cool and quiet and going off clearing brush. The vice president doesn't seem so willing to take, you know, a backstage. Why is that?
Well, you know, there used to be a tradition that former presidents and former vice presidents kept their criticisms pretty much to themselves. But over the past 8 years, you got to say, that custom has not been honored, not by Al Gore, not by, certainly by former President Carter, not even by President Clinton. So I'm afraid we're in rougher times than we used to be. Now, if you listen to what Cheney has had to say, he really hasn't been so much critical. He hasn't been mean, although people see him that way. He has merely expressed concerns because he's worried that policies that he believes have kept America safe from terrorist attacks over these past 7 years may be thrown out the window, and that if that happens, we'll get hit.
Well, He had his shot for 8 years. There's two issues. Let's break it down, Cliff. One is whether he should or should not be speaking. I mean, right. At least those other presidents waited some amount of time, some years, I think, before Clinton ever spoke up, you know, and said anything whatsoever. There was deference. And this is an immediate, I mean, he immersed himself immediately into the national and international conversation.
Al Gore, I seem to remember essentially calling Bush a traitor. I mean, just screaming about him. Maybe he waited longer to do it. And Cheney hasn't done that. What he said
Was that? I don't.
There was a famous speech where he really went ballistic. You don't remember that speech? We could Google it for the next time.
No.
It was over Iraq and what and his opposition to the Iraq War.
Okay, well then that was the Iraq War took place, you know, a year and a half into the administration.
All right, so you're saying he should have waited a little longer. Look, I think valid criticism, that's fine. Maybe he should have, maybe he shouldn't have. But I also think his concerns are worth discussing. And his concerns
Let's move on to that. Yeah. His concerns about he's saying torture. That torture kept us safe. I mean,
he's not really saying that, but I mean, I don't think that's a fair characterization.
Rendition.
Yeah, rendition is a policy, but you're okay. Right on rendition, you can say it. But by the way, rendition is a policy that so far, at least, Obama has not gotten rid of, and I give him credit for that.
Well, we don't know that yet. We do not.
He has not said we're no longer going to have rendition. He has not said that. Or if he has, I haven't seen it. Maybe you have.
Because, the whole idea was we blew the top on rendition. It was a secret, covert program, perhaps. He's actually minding protocol, security protocol.
Rendition was a secret program when Bush used it. It was a secret program when Clinton used it. And it's meant to be a secret program when Obama uses it. But Obama has not said, no more rendition. If we can get somebody like a Khalid Sheikh Mohammed at a boarding house in Karachi and get him out of there, we're going to do it.
Well, that's not exactly what it is. That's about rendition is about just taking the people we have and getting other people to torture them for us.
No. Rendition is separate from the interrogation methods. What rendition is you capture somebody on foreign soil and you bring him out so that you can interrogate him and detain him.
You take them to places where you're not torturing them on U.S. soil, so they're thereby in some screwy way not violating the constructs of the Geneva Convention. I mean, that's what it is. It's an end run around the Geneva Convention.
No, I don't think it is at all. I don't think the Geneva Convention applies to Osama bin Laden or to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Look, if we knew that bin Laden was driving down a street in Karachi, would you and I agree that it's okay to kill him right there?
Absolutely.
Would it be all right to capture him right there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, would it be all right to put him into a plane and get him out of the country?
Yeah, and bring him back to the United States and put him on trial and put him in prison for the rest of his life or capital punishment, whatever jurisdiction.
Okay, so the only
disagreement
we have is whether he should go to a place like Guantanamo, whether he should go here, whether he should.
But you're talking about bin Laden versus and here's where Cheney, kind of full circle, Cliff May is my guess, full circle here, is that if they were so worried about capturing bin Laden, then why is he still out there? He hasn't been smoked out of his hole. They fought this whole distraction in Iraq, just the war on terror. This is what I debated Bill O'Reilly on last night, and he was mad that somehow they've lost the distinction among who the terrorists are. Well, distinctions matter. You can't just say the war against terror because, you know, and then put everything under that rubric because that diffuse energy didn't catch bin Laden, and two, the blowback worldwide from the Muslim world was far worse than if we had been surgical and said this is a war against Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, who's housed in Afghanistan and parts of Pakistan. Don't you agree?
In part, I do. I mean, I'm glad, for example, on two things. One is, and we talked about this in Hardball as well, that President Obama has said, I'm going to concentrate on Afghanistan. I'm not going to allow us to lose in Afghanistan. I'm sending more troops to Afghanistan. So I'm glad he's doing that. I hope you're glad about that as well.
Yes, I am. I just bought someone on the left. Just before you, who thinks we have no business that the war has drug on too long. My point being, we if we had a huge, if in war you had mulligans, Cliff May, had we focused solely on Afghanistan and Al Qaeda, who knows what a situation we could have been. This could have been over and done with, much like Kosovo.
Maybe so. We'll certainly see how hard it is here. Look, I think reasonably people can disagree about whether or not we should have gotten involved in Iraq when we did. Reasonable people did disagree on that. There were many Democrats who were in favor of that. As you know, the Iraq Liberation Act was passed and signed into law by President Clinton, not by President Bush.
Under complete threat of patriotic.
No. President Clinton. Under Clinton in 1998.
I thought you were talking about
Liberation Act.
I thought you were talking about the authorization for.
No. I'm talking about the Iraq Liberation Act passed under President Clinton.
That was regime change.
The most important regime change we could have in the world. But let's not replay that from years ago. You wanted to talk about Cheney. Cheney is saying, look, the Patriot Act we need. The Patriot Act tumbled the wall between intelligence and law enforcement. Very important. He's saying we need to be able to detain enemy combatants as long as necessary. We can't put them all on trial in the U.S. He's saying we shouldn't take prisoners from Guantanamo and release them into the U.S.
And you agree with all three of those things. You agree?
I do think those are all important policies that we have to look at very carefully. Look, right now.
Let me ask you a question. What has the Patriot Act done beyond, what can you prove? Because they went back and they've had several revisions, if you will. Mm-hmm. It did cross constitutional lines. We did find that the courts found that it was illegal and unwarranted wiretapping.
No. Quite the opposite, Nancy. Quite the opposite. And as a matter of fact, as you know, Senator Obama voted for the FISA reform, which allows what you call warrantless wiretapping. We can do it. It is being done right now. You don't need probable cause. And the highest court on this, which is the FISA Court of Review, found that this was, in fact, constitutional. There has been no court ruling that saying it's not constitutional, Obama is for it.
He voted for it. He only owned that provision as part of a larger package. Cliff, I was involved in the vice presidential debate material, so I knew that it was with certain court authorizations and part of a larger national security package.
I supported the bill that he voted for, and right now we can listen in on phone calls from Waziristan to Detroit without getting probable cause and warrant.
No one's calling Detroit because they don't want to buy any cars. There's no reason. There is no reason to call Detroit.
If there are multiple calls from Waziristan or from Karachi, you do not need probable cause at the moment. And by the way, the telecommunications companies, which cooperated with the government after 9/11, did get the immunity they sought, which, as you know, the ACLU and MoveOn.org opposed. Again, I give great credit to Obama. He was opposed to that. In the end, he thought about it and he voted for it.
And he's closing Guantanamo and dealing with those prisoners in a way that is going to restore confidence in the rest of the world that we act according to the rule of law and national and international law so that we have fewer terrorists to go hunt and what's the verb form of rendition? Renite. Render.
He has said he will close Guantanamo. We haven't done. He hasn't done it yet because he doesn't quite know how or what to do with
them. They'll do it in a year.
By the way, we got two problems with this that we do have to work out. One is, for example, we now have a Taliban leader in Afghanistan who was in Guantanamo after he'd been captured and then was later released, and we know he's now back out fighting the Americans there. And two,
hey, Cliff. Do you want to hold on through the break? Because then we'll put you on hold. Because there's my music and my producer's yelling at me that I'm several shades of late. He said. John did 1-888-64-NANCY, the number of the program. If you want to jump in here with Cliff May, who's defending Dick Cheney, God bless him. He's the only one I could find that would defend Dick Cheney right now other than, I don't even know if his wife is defending him right now. 1-888-0-NANCY is the other line you can use on the Nancy Skinner Show. Okay, let's dive right back in here. More love letters from my viewers last night on the O'Reilly Factor. I will share with you. Coming up, just if you thought that the first ones were good, wait till you see the other ones. I treat my guests with different opinions with a whole different level of respect and congeniality. Cliff May is with me because Cliff's a nice guy. He's also the president for the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Cliff and I have been on some of these shows together in the past. What would we say? Just engaging in a spirited debate?
I think that's a good way to say it. I think it's always cordial.
Do you get hate mail when you go on from, do you get liberals that call, that write you and just say the most god-awful things you've ever read? Or no?
I do get hate mail, have for years. I wouldn't say it's necessarily from liberals. Usually it's from crazies if it's real hate mail. And I'm not sure, sometimes they're far to the left, sometimes they're far to the right, sometimes I can't even figure out. I just know they dislike me.
Yeah, well, I guess you just have to have a tough skin
in
this business. And, okay, so let's talk a little bit just here because we don't have a whole lot of time, beyond Dick Cheney, because he's gone. Okay, what is he going to do? What is Dick Cheney going to do? Is he going to get a job somewhere?
I don't think so. I think he's sort of semi-retired. I guess he'll do some hunting, though. I probably won't. don't want to be invited.
Yeah, watch out for that. No, is he going to be? Is he going to start to be like a Fred Thompson like radio show and opine? Wouldn't that be something? The Dick Cheney Show.
Yeah, it could be interesting. I kind of doubt he's not the most sociable fella in a way. He's kind of a serious guy. I would imagine that he'll write. He may do some little bit of speaking and that sort of thing. I don't really claim to know.
All right. So now our new president is getting much better reception than our old president. You got to agree. The rest of the world, they have faith that he's going to be more diplomatic, and he's willing to sit down with. Our enemies already accepting invitations from China, Russia, and other places. What's wrong with that model of sitting down? I don't know how you felt about it during the campaign, but certainly to sit down with someone, even if you're going to have a tough negotiation, it's going to be an uncomfortable conversation, but it's better than no conversation, is it not?
Look, I have nothing against the diplomacy, and I think it's great that he's over in Europe for the G20. And of course, you see, nonetheless, you have anti-capitalist rioters who don't seem to have been entirely charmed by President Obama, kicking up a stir outside the meetings that are.
But that's not Obama. That's the global meltdown that was caused by the lack of coordination and regulation internationally that caused it.
So you're on the side of the protesters? You think they have an idea that's
no.
worth listening to?
No. I'm not an anarchist.
Okay.
But I do think that there has to be more cooperation. Certainly, yeah.
I'm saying everybody doesn't love him, and I'm saying it's good for him to talk to everybody, or not, or almost everybody. I'd say be cautious. For example, sitting down to talk with Iran, because the problem is not that we misunderstand each other, or we need to hold hands, or have a sensitivity training session. If you go into a diplomatic negotiation, it is good to have a little bit of leverage on your side.
I'm out of time, Cliff. I'm so sorry about that.
Great to talk to you, Nancy.
Cliff May, the president for the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. Thanks, Cliff. We'll come back more. Wait till you read this email. This is pretty funny. It's making me crack up. What the heck? I can take it. I'm tough. Nancy Skinner and the Nancy Skinner Show. How do you like that? Asian stocks higher on news of possible U.S. auto bankruptcy. Happy about that, folks? I know I've not. This has been like how many, an hour and a half that I've gone without talking about the auto industry. You better believe I'm going to get back to it and give you a big old I told you so on this. It's not going to happen, but even the prospect of it. Japanese, Asian markets are higher. Yay! Maybe the U.S. auto industry will go bankrupt. Is that really the outcome that we want, folks? The polls were at 70% to 30%. And that's the number right now saying that the auto industry, we should extend help to the auto industry so that the Asian stock markets rise on the prospect of failure of the U.S. auto industry. Is that patriotic? Is that American? Do you feel good about that? You in the 70%? No, I know you don't. I know that you don't, and that's not an intended consequence. I do know that. But that is the reality, that the prospect of that is helping our Asian neighbors on the planet and hurting our own prospects. All right, I'm not going to get into that right now. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program, because we are going to be getting back to that, obviously, in that news and continuing. There's been some developments in terms of the auto industry, and obviously I'm acutely concerned about it and spent a little bit of time on foreign policy. Did you notice that? I did notice that of all the progressive shows and whatnot out there, I do talk a little bit more about the economy and whatnot than I do foreign policy. So I just, even my shows, because I watch, I love Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow. I love all those shows on MSNBC, but they often spend a lot more time talking about foreign policy than they do the economy sometimes. And I understand that. And I used to talk a lot about that when the war in Iraq was a raging dispute, but we have a global meltdown that's a raging dispute. So if I get emails saying, why do you talk so much about the economy and the auto industry? If you've been listening to me for 10 years or so, I talk about what I believe to be the most important issue at the time. Sometimes it's global warming. Sometimes it's foreign policy. Right now, I believe it's the economic meltdown, because it's happening here and it's happening abroad. Protesters today breaking into the Royal Bank of Scotland, rioters shouting abolish money. I mean, you know, who are these? These are kids. These are 20-year-old anarchists who are getting caught up in a storm that is real, the storm called the global economic meltdown. That is a real storm. But the kids breaking in to these banks and whatnot, these young anarchists, be very careful about how this is portrayed. Because there are always anarchists, and there are people who are on the losing side of a global economy, of course. And this idea, I just had this conversation with Cliff May from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, and people mad that I'm even debating someone on this. Someone just wrote me, this lady, and said she's so mad. How dare I even, why would I even debate somebody? Well, because the debate is being had across the world, madam. Right now, even among countries, you have Germany and France, Nicolas Sarkozy, if you want to be Jean-Paul Francais, is, you know, threatening to walk out of the G20 summit. And in Germany, Angela Merkel are saying, enough of the stimulus package. We want tighter regulation. You have essentially the U.S. and the U.K. allied in the Keynesian economic model. President Obama today in his press conference with Gordon Brown said, hey, look it. We can't do all the heavy lifting here ourselves. So this is what the big debate is going on at the G20 right now, is how are we going to overcome this whole global financial meltdown? Because in fact, it is global, and the outlook isn't good. You know, the guy I talk about a lot on the show, Dr. Doom. I've got that in my head. Nouriel Roubini, who is a professor of business at the New York Stern School of Business at NYU, says that economic outlook for the OECD, those are the advanced economic countries, is something like 4.3% decline in 2009. That's what he's looking at. That's a big number. That's a big decline in global economic activity that he expects to continue. And it's across the board. So even in Japan, they are forecasting for the U.S. a 4% decline in 2009, and 0%, no growth in 2010. In other words, 2009 is our tough year. And then in 2010, he's predicting just a flat growth. Japan, 6.6% decline in economic growth. And then they will in 2010 be 0.5% economic growth, or I don't know what's the opposite of growth. The Eurozone, he calls it, is negative 4.1%. Brazil's GDP is expected to decline by just 0.3% in 2009, while Russia is projected to fall 5.6%. Growth in India will ease back to 4.3% this year. Now that's positive growth. And China, 6.3%, positive. But these economies were growing at 8-9%, okay? So what you have going on here is this great transfer of wealth that has been happening for the last, two decades, really, but exacerbated by NAFTA and GATT, where we, the buyer of last resort of all cheap junk at Walmart, where we have been essentially, we brought the billions in poverty in China and India, a step further up from poverty, if you will, because they have had no unions. They haven't been able to allow that money to trickle down to the populations. And then certainly in areas where you have regimes that have dependent on petrodollars, you have young, angry populations where the wealth has gone to the concentrated few. So you've got this world situation with the G20 where President Obama is correct when he says, look, folks, you have to be able to stimulate your economy as well. It is not just us, because we are, obviously, we've had the stimulus plan. The budget includes a good deal of infrastructure and spending. And it's to get consumer spending going again, to get our economy going again. What happens when our economy is going again? Then the rest of the world will pull out of it. So everybody's kind of looking to the United States to spend our way out of the global economic meltdown, slowdown, okay, if you will. I'll use that word. So they're looking to us to do that. And what the president is saying is we can't do that alone. So you have had different models of government, France and Germany, that are a little bit, you have more of a safety net. You have health insurance for your populace. So when people get unemployed there, they don't lose their health insurance. Things aren't quite as drastic, quite as do or die in these European nations, if you will, when their economy tanks 4%. Here it goes down, and look what happens. We've lost 4 million jobs. People lose their health insurance. We have tent cities cropping up. Industries on the brink that will cascade into other industries. So, you know, he's doing some tough negotiating. It was interesting. I've been following the commentary. A lot of people said, well, he's going to go there and mostly listen. And that's good because that's something President Bush didn't do, and that cost us a lot of ire in the rest of the world. But he ended up being, according to Chuck Todd on NBC today, ended up being a little bit more forceful, having to really sit down with these our European allies and say, look, folks, you know, the free ride is over here with the United States. Everybody's got to step up to the plate. And, yes, we will have to have some form of global cooperation. And I don't care what the whack jobs say when you start bringing up that word. I'm not talking global currency. I mean, it's a different thing. But in terms of cooperation among the banks and the financial sectors in the world, I believe absolutely. I know without a doubt there has to be more cooperation. Because look at, you know, who's not there? Who's not at the G20? All these offshore havens where people are, these corporations and wealthy individuals are able to hide and secret their profits from these schemes, from these hedge funds and credit default swaps and just the multilateral trade deals that they're getting because of cheap labor. They're not there. There's got to be some body that regulates that so that people have, every country is essentially playing by some rules of the road. That's it. That's all. It's as general as it has to be. Rules of the road so that wealthy industrial nations like the United States and the UK are not the only ones paying for all of this party on planet Earth and then paying the price when things go bust because it's boom or bust. And when they go bust, they really go bust. And it involves political unrest and it involves our military gusto to go in and solve a lot of these problems. So it's hard for people to understand because they don't like, you know, they get nervous. And I know I get emails from people all the time talking about Bilderbergers and all the internationalists concerned about any sort of cooperation in the financial regulation of banks. But it has to happen. We can't do it all. So it's in our interest to get them to pony up, okay? And, yes, we need more regulation, and the president has already said that that's going to be a big part of the whole go forward. We're going to fix what's broken now. We need this new authority to regulate non-bank institutions so that we don't ever go through this again, and there will be a boatload of regulation, I assure you. So to look at, try to identify systemic problems before they mature into meltdowns, if you will, And we're going to do that. That's what we're going to do. Okay, rest of the world, what you're going to do is you're going to pony up as well. And we all got to work together on this because isn't that a weird thing in a way? Because we have to. It's in our own self-interest to work together with the rest of the world. And so we can tell Nicolas Sarkozy and his model bride. Everyone's, yeah. The big news, I can't believe, MSNBC, they're talking about, will Michelle Obama, how will she look next to Sarkozy's wife, this model? Are you kidding me? Like, for real? Did some assignment editor really give you the job of figuring out what Michelle Obama was going to wear and what Sarkozy's wife was going to wear and to do a segment on that? Because I did. I saw several segments on that. So somewhere, some editor said, hey, I've got a great idea. G20 summit. What's Michelle wearing? And whatever Mrs. Sarkozy is wearing. Oh, my goodness. All right. The GOP coming up. They came out on April Fool's with their alternative budget today. It would be funny if it weren't. On April Fool's Day, no one thought through that. They presented their real numbers and how they're going to save the economy. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the Nancy Skinner program. I know I said I would get into the alternative GOP budget. I'm going to because it's funny. But it is a Nancy Skinner show. I'm Nancy Skinner, 1-888-64-NANCY. Or 1, oh, Nancy just spilled her coffee all over her console. That's the other number to the program. Oh, I did that. Thank you, Joel. Yeah, I did that a lot. Me spilling coffee, imagine that. But before we move into that area, I just have to, you know, I'm reading this article about... This is an AP story on the G20 protesters breaking into the Royal Bank of Scotland in London. And, you know, this is what distresses me. Because this happens all the time when there are international meetings, any sort of meeting, the way they report this. At least 4,000 anarchists, anti-capitalists, environmentalists, and others, okay, other whack jobs, jammed into London's financial district for what they call Financial Fool's Day. They always throw the environmentalists in with anti-capitalists and anarchists. I guarantee you, thoughtful scientists who are trying to find alternatives to the fossil fuel-based climate change situation are not in the streets of London, if you will, shouting phrases like class warfare, thieves, and abolish money. And so when they throw that word environmentalist into these reports, it sends shivers down my spine because, first of all, it's just, I mean, anyone can call themselves anything they want. They're thugs. They're kids. They're thugs. And when you have populations... Young populations, if you look at the pictures and if you've seen any of the video of these people, when people don't have a job, and this is the same thing that happened with terrorism, when they don't have a job, when they feel economic anxiety, when you have these huge extremes of haves and have-nots, and then someone comes along and points a finger at who done it, who lit the fire, you have mob rule. I mean, that's what is happening. You have mobs. So these mobs are going in now. This is the situation with the Royal Bank of Scotland. The UK, similar anger against that bank and the situation, the bailouts, as has happened here. Royal Bank of Scotland was bailed out by the British taxpayers. They had a series of disastrous deals that had brought it to the brink of bankruptcy. It's now majority owned by the British taxpayer. And, again, they had a similar situation there. Their former CEO, Fred Goodwin, a 50-year-old executive, managed to walk off with $1 million annual pension for life, while unemployment in Britain now tops 2 million and is heading toward 3 million by the end of this year, according to this report. So, you know, the haves and the have-nots, people, is that really too hard to understand as a story? Because it's kind of the story of history. No news here. Really, haves and have-nots, and empires grow and then they bust, and essentially that's what's happening. Unless you would like to think that we as a people evolve, is that possible? And instead of picking up armaments and TVs and throwing them into the windows at the Royal Bank of Scotland, or invading another country to get resources that you don't have, as we did in ancient days. That, in fact, we could talk to our fellow planeteers and sit down and say, okay, we seem to be having this cycle, this problem with international banking, these booms and busts that cause great unrest and havoc on the planet. What can we do about that without, you know, the nationalistic cultures getting so darn cranky. Okay, so I'm dealing here with coffee all over my laptop as I try to explain the meltdown among the haves and the have-nots at the G20 summit. All in a day's work, and receiving plenty of hate mail from my Bill O'Reilly listeners. On that note, I'm going to invite your calls at 1-888-64-NANCY or 1-888-0-NANCY. Oh my God, Nancy, what have you done? I'll clean up my coffee and my computer and my new BlackBerry Storm that got drenched. And we're going to pick up where we left off. We're going to be talking a little bit about what you can do, self-service coming up here, every volunteer service, what you can do right now to make yourself feel better a little bit. And then I really am this guy, Patrick Ryan, who's going to come on the program at some point, the representative who introduced the alternative budget today is going to join us, but I've got some of his sound from today of their plan, their great big idea, all that coming up on a dry, on a cleaned, non-coffee stained Nancy Skinner program. Some trouble. I got more to cause. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. 1-888-64-NANCY. Or 1, if you want the old number, if you want to do things the old way, 866-991-9927. We are going to get to the alternative GOP budget, which, according to the Huffington Post, one White House aide calls a joke. Got some sound on that. Because it is a joke. It is exactly the wrong prescription for this period of time where we're going through this the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, and what we need is a fiscal stimulus worldwide, as we're seeing riots across the world about that. And you have the GOP saying a spending freeze across the board, which would make it's like telling someone who has cancer just like start smoking would be the short answer. But somebody, my next guest has the picture right here, and even goes a step further, I should say. Harvard professor Linda Bilmes is the co-author of The People Factor, Strengthening America by Investing in Public Service. She's a former Clinton Administration Commerce Assistant Secretary, and she co-authored this particular book with a vice president at IBM. And they make the case in their latest book that instead of shrinking the federal government, what we really need to do is make a $10 billion investment in our federal workforce over the next 5 years, which could result in something like $300 to $600 billion on the other side by getting the right people in, training them well, and investing once again in the public sector. A tough case to make, even for a Harvard professor with all her accolades, right in this environment against this crowd, but she's here to do it. Professor Bilmes, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Nancy.
So, yeah, the timing on this, obviously, people don't understand with the budget, the stimulus plan and the budget numbers being so high, now you're calling for another $10 billion investment. That's hard just on the timing of that is hard. Or are you doing it because of the timing?
Well, I think we really can't afford not to spend some money on the people who actually have got to implement all of the programs. You know, all of the change that we just voted for is not going to happen and not going to get implemented if we don't make an investment in the people who actually have to run the programs and supervise the contracts and do all the actual grunt work. You know, there are 1.9 million federal workers in this country. They are spread all over the country doing everything from being air traffic controllers to food inspectors to, Army Corps of Engineers employees. And, you know, this group of people basically have now been given the job of rescuing the banking sector and laying the groundwork for healthcare reform and energy independence and rebuilding the infrastructure.
And maybe the auto industry, maybe a turnaround of the auto industry.
That's right. But we are really suffering from the fact that we have really, for the past 30 years, have severely underinvested in this workforce. And I think that the sort of attitude that we've had toward the federal workers is kind of epitomized by you remember back to the Ronald Reagan quip where he said, what are the 9 scariest words in the English language? They are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But now I think we see that big government is actually really, really important to this country.
Well, well-managed government. And the size, I agree with you, Professor, the size of it had to grow by necessity. It's been neglected because of a lot of the ideological attacks on it. But you're right. If you don't get the best and brightest people there, how are they going to do their job? And so here's my question. How does this is civil service mostly, right? Are we talking about the...
That's right. We're really talking about civil servants.
Not the political appointees, because they come and
go. Well, we actually suggest that we have fewer political appointees, because one of the reasons that the career appointees are demoralized is because they have a constant turnover in political appointees coming in who don't know typically how to manage things, who are telling them what to do.
A.K.A. hacks, right?
Well, you know, if you are somebody who you're running a sort of large technical operation, you know, you're working with 65 other engineers working on something, I mean, you may or may not welcome a political appointee who is a non-engineer to help you run something. I mean, I think that we suggest that there's more training for the political appointees as well.
Right. Well, then, you know, I'll go strong. I know you can only go so far, especially during the Bush administration. You had folks who were completely ill-qualified to do those roles. So I imagine that there's a certain after effect about that, where you have people who work for the oil companies going in to manage EPA, for instance, and redacting documents.
So the
residual ill will from that remains in the civil service, and there's some fence mending to do, first of all, right?
I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what we see, I mean, anywhere you look, whether you look at the poor intelligence that led us into Iraq in the first place, if you look at the federal government response to the cleanup of Hurricane Katrina, if you look at the situation at Walter Reed Hospital, the regulatory failures around the Madoff scandal and everything else, the current situation with the peanut butter, tainting of the peanut butter and the lack of oversight over you know, peanut inspections. Anywhere you look, the root cause of this situation is that we have a federal workforce that is overburdened, being tasked with more than it ever has been before. It's the smallest it has been since the before the Kennedy administration. And we have not trained or put any money into investing the quality of people. And now this is, it's been a problem. It's turning into a crisis because the vast majority of the experienced people are ready to retire. You have, for example, almost 90% of the air traffic controllers in this country are going to be soon eligible to retire, and we just don't have the pipeline of people to replace them.
So what do we do about it, Professor? What's the answer? Train
them?
Well,
we have to revamp completely our hiring and recruiting system. We have to significantly increase training, and we have to make the work more flexible. We have to make a more flexible arrangement so that we can use, for example, retired veterans benefits claims officers to help out getting the backlog of veterans claims under control. Right now we're so inflexible that we have people, thousands of people all over the country who know how to do things and want to help and volunteer but not do full-time jobs, and we can't really take advantage of them.
And this will require an investment. You're saying we're going to have to put $10 billion into this whole training process, but like any investment, it will yield, you're estimating something like $300 to $600 billion in payoff in terms of the downstream effects. How do you get that number, first of all?
Well, one of the reasons that we get that number is because right now you have 1.9 million civil servants. There are about 6 million contractors or more. In other words, people working on contracts. But the people who are working in the government full-time really have not been trained in how to manage these contracts, how to oversee the cost of these contracts. And so a very, very significant percentage of federal contracts, as most listeners know, and as we have certainly seen in Iraq, go on unsupervised, undersupervised, over budget. They don't meet their specifications, and what you end up with is a lot of unnecessary spending. And since you essentially have 3/4 of the work of government being done by the contract workforce, the poor oversight, you know, of that entire workforce by the core workforce is resulting in a lot of unnecessary spending.
Ah, waste, fraud, and abuse. You just summed it up for me right there. A lot of waste and fraud and abuse, probably because they're not well managed, they're not well trained, and so you're
saying... A lot of it is duplication. A lot of it is not understanding, for example, in major IT projects, not really having a good sense of controlling the timing of the contracts. A lot of it is in the structuring of contracts, how the actual specifications for the contracts are written, how the contracts are then managed, what kind of metrics are put in place to manage the contract, at what point you decide, you know, this is good enough or it's not good enough or we want to use a different contractor. All of that is something which has to be taught and trained. People are not born knowing it.
Right.
But we have not really given our workforce the tools to know how to do that effectively.
My last question is, to get in any great company, you know, good to great, or any good business book that you would read, you need to attract the best people to do that kind of thing. And how can the federal government, which doesn't pay what it does in the private sector, and which now it carries, especially with the political appointees, these vetting from hell processes that these candidates are going through. Tim Geithner can't even get help over at Treasury during a meltdown. How do you even entice smart people like yourself? You're a Harvard Law professor, Assistant Secretary of Commerce in the Clinton administration. Professor Linda Bill Mays. Is that how you say your name?
That's what
my producer said. Okay.
Bilmes.
What would entice you to go work for President Obama? Or what would be the general guidelines that you would give him to get smart people like yourselves going into federal service again?
Well, I think that this is a very, very important question. Right now you have a very significant portion of the federal workforce that is retiring and a lot of difficulty in getting the best and the brightest into government. It's because the hiring system is severely broken. Right now it takes us 82 days to give a job offer to a college graduate. In the private sector at the outside, it's a six-week time frame, 4 to 6 weeks. And in our book, The People Factor, we surveyed 2,000 college students, and we found that they said that they could not afford financially to wait for more than 4 to 6 weeks to make a decision about a job. The government takes 3 months on average, with many of the most important agencies taking 4 or 5 months to get back to a college kid and let them know whether or not they have a job. So we've got to get a lot more clever about how we actually think about recruiting, how we think about hiring. Then once we do hire them, there's a very, very high attrition rate because we don't mentor them, we don't have retention programs, we don't train them, we don't take care of them. And so all of that needs to be overhauled and brought into line with best 21st century practice.
That sounds exhausting to me. but you've
you know,
done
it. It is. And this issue is an issue which is not that sexy, but it is critically important because if we do not do this, we really are not going to have a government that performs well.
Right. It's atrophied. They're overburdened.
Right.
They're under supported and maligned, and now we just heaped a whole lot more responsibility on that group of people. Well, Linda, the book is The People Factor, Strengthening America by Investing in Public Service. And you've done a public service by taking the time to do this thorough research and prescribe some remedies for the situation. So I appreciate you spending a little time. I think this is a sexy topic because if these people who are running the government and trying to bail all of us out in the world, if they are underwater and upside down, then we're in trouble. So we need to throw them a lifeline as well, right?
We really do. I know we're out of time, but
yep.
If you saw the Republican response to a State of the Union address, they started saying that we have too much government. And that's exactly the opposite of what we should be saying. What we should be saying is, how do we strengthen government and make it work better?
Well, that's quite an argument to make, and so I'm going to read this book because I go on all these shows and fight Bill O'Reilly, and I need all the ammo I can get.
Absolutely.
Send me the book, and I'll make the case. Invest more.
Okay.
We actually need a bigger government. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Professor Linda Bilmes is her name. Smart lady. See? What do you think about that? I have an economist on the line I see in my calls. So we'll see what an economist says about that. And my producer says, I think you're late. Thanks, John. I realize that. 1-888-64-NANCY. 1-888-NANCY on the Nancy Skinner Show. Quick, hurry, hand me a knife. I need to cut myself more. I'm trying to think of stupid analogies for the alternative GOP budget. Oh, they're proposing a freeze, repeal of the entire fiscal stimulus package and
April
a spending
Fool.
Freeze. April Fool. No, it's not. It's really their plan is to stop all spending stimulus right now as the economy goes into a tailspin. Right? Please help me with how bad this analogy is, because obviously I'm not doing the job. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number of the program, or 866-991-9927, another number. Mark, I understand, is an economist in Orange County, California. He's been following our discussion about the haves and the have-nots and the do and the do-nots, and joins us now. Thanks for hanging on the line, Mark.
Sure. First, I enjoy your show. Second, I couldn't agree more strongly with Professor Bonet's about the looming and completely ignored problem of the worker shortage that we'll be facing in just the next few years. And third, the reason for my calls is I wanted to make some comments about the false dichotomy in the dialogue about what should be done vis-a-vis the stimulus and what should be done vis-a-vis global policy.
Great.
Dealing with the financial crisis. Something that's in some cases being missed, and in other cases, like the Republican alternative budget plan, being deliberately obscured, is the fact that haves and have-nots, consumer workers and business, are both legitimate and essential counterparties in the economy. And if
Agreed.
You go back to Ricardo or Adam Smith, that's spelled out, you know, without any aspersions between one side or the other. In every transaction, whether it's payment for labor or purchase of goods or services, there's a multiplier effect. And the counterparty, the seller of services or and goods or the seller of labor, benefits.
Mark, I absolutely agree with everything you're saying, and I would love to hear the second part of it. I have 20 seconds till what I have is a hard break. Can you hang on so we can hear?
Yes, sir.
Because I think you made the point clearly that that's part of the equation. I think I'm not going to say what he's going to say. He'll say it. Mark from Orange County, California, will say it on the other side. And you can say it, 1-888-64-NANCY, the new number on the Nancy Skinner Show.
Thinly veiled attempt by Washington to spend its way into prosperity, tax its way into tax release, and borrow its way into debt reduction. This simply cannot work. But as I have always said, and you've heard me say this all throughout this debate, it is not enough for us to just criticize. We must also propose a better way forward. And that's exactly what we've done in the past, and that's exactly what we're here to do today. Because we are here offering up our Republican budget alternative.
On April Fool's Day.
I poop.
Doesn't anyone else think that's kind of funny? That we finally got, where's the beef? The beef came on April Fool's Day, the actual plan. And if you know anything about economics, it's the absolute reverse prescription for what we need. It is the exact opposite, polar opposite of what you need in this kind of situation, to repeal the fiscal stimulus completely and to stop, to put a spending freeze in place. I've got more and more. It's fun. I actually thought it is April Fool's. Mark from Orange County was an economist on the line with us before the break, talking about the macro have and have not situation and the economy. And so we've gotten to the point, Mark, just so people who are just tuning in, you were saying that in every, almost all economists and people who get this agree that there are haves and have nots. Nobody's intending. Well, I suppose there have been regimes who have intended to have, you know, equalize it and have communism. But the idea is you're going to have people that are better off and people who aren't, and some, you know, labor and management. And you're going to that is a natural part of the equation. That's where you had gotten to before the but and before the break. And so I'll let you finish. Thanks for hanging on, first of all.
Yeah, sure. And the most important point is, they need each other, but there does have to be parity, and both sides have to be healthy. We lost parity. We lost a tremendous amount of parity over the last 20-25 years with the declining standard of living and declining financial security of the bottom 98%. From a rhetoric standpoint, I think the Obama administration should be pressing that point, saying two things. Number one, guys, business, Republicans, these are the customers of industry we're talking about helping. We're talking about supporting with mortgage assistance programs.
Mm-hmm.
if you want healthy business, who are they going to sell to?
Right.
You know, we've sold them up to an enormous percentage of their current income and then sold them more on debt, which is their future income. You got no,
while at the same time, while you're trying to repress their wage growth, which represses their consumer spending ability, which represses your profits.
And then the repressed net sum you've extracted in the form of debt that you're profiting from the debt income, and you profited in fees as you made the loans.
Right. Now, you don't take our word for it, Mark. Alan Greenspan has been recently, I would say in the last year or so, preaching about this and the danger he sees posed by income inequality across the planet, in our country and across the planet. He said that he wrote a book or he gave a talk or something. I saw a Charlie Rose special or something where he really said he saw income inequality as the greatest threat to our economic security.
Yeah, well, you know, even latecomers are welcome, and he's right. I wish he'd come around to that conclusion
when he could have done something about it, like when he could have. He kept putting the brake on. This is what got me is as Fed chair, you could have. Allowed, you know, there's the fear is of inflation for people that don't get with the role of the Fed is that the fear of inflation is so paralyzing to Wall Street that they kept putting the brakes on growth when the economy was getting to the point during the Clinton administration where the wages were starting to finally, after a couple decades, the median wages were starting to tick up a little bit. People had a little bit more spending power. So what, fear of inflation caused them to put the brake on the interest rates and the flow of money, and they kept going to the point where the global economy started the deflationary cycle, which Mark, I've been talking about for my co-host said that I predicted it, you know, a few years back. These are big trends. They're not surprises. They're big long-term trends in aggregate demand and supply.
No, absolutely. And we've had one major party, and quite honestly, a party that much of my adult life I was a registered member of, that has been running against running on rhetoric against government rather than running for consumers and business. Business, you know, the very wealthy have benefited. Business has not, as is evidenced by the sorry state of businesses from the auto industry on through the spectrum. But another point I would like to
I'm going to throw this is another cut. I want to get your reaction to this, Patrick Ryan, this representative of the alternative plan. So you're getting what the economist Mark and I are saying, right? So everyone's following that. So you got this have and have nots, and there's not enough demand to buy the goods, right? So what is the alternative GOP plan vis-a-vis corporations?
Now, we also think we need to get private capital off of the sidelines and back into the marketplace. We need to get jobs in this economy. And so to get this economy growing, we propose a number of reforms. Number one, cut the corporate tax rate. Currently, it's the second highest in the industrialized world to the average industrialized nation rate, 25%. You see, when we tax our employers and our jobs more than our competitors tax theirs, we lose jobs. Whether we like it or not, we are in a highly competitive 21st century global economy, and we will either lead or follow. I say we lead. I say we have to help our businesses, big and small, compete and thrive in the global economy.
You know, it's.
We also propose to suspend the capital gains tax through the year 2010.
So it's like, it is like, are you obese? Keep eating. Are you stressed out? Go drive in rush hour traffic. I can't even get over how absolutely ridiculous, if you, as Mark, as an economist, prescription that is. Knowing what the problem is, they're saying reduce corporate taxes and the dividends, and then all of a sudden businesses will have more incentive to start investing more, so that what? That, you know, people can, so they can build up their inventories beyond the enormous excess that exists right now?
Yeah. Well, in a healthier economy, in a healthier economic structure and financial market structure than we've had since about 1988. There is some validity to testing the argument of lower business taxes.
Sure, however, at the other extreme, like way on the other extreme. Like
absolutely.
In closed economies where you do have, when we had closed economies, when we had inflationary and stagflation, it's because we didn't have the mobility of capital that we do right now. That's the problem. You know, we've loosened up this global economy so that money can flow anywhere, to the cheap labor, and there's not going to be a tight labor market in a global economy for a long time, a few lifetimes from now.
Since the late 80s, with the diminution of regulation in the financial markets and with the multiple restructurings of the tax code, I have to say, especially under Clinton, what has happened is every time there's been a tax cut, every time there's been any sort of tax benefit, increases in globalization that have raised revenue or reduced costs to business, rather than the majority of that flowing through to new investment and new hiring, it has flowed through to
hedge funds,
either new borrowing or new stock issues. It has enriched the owners.
Right.
And that multiple that used to go
and leverage them to gamble in an environment where they were, you know, basically gambling on these instruments with other people's money because they were just getting this enormous an embarrassment of riches from which to gamble.
In 2004, Duke Energy was just about to take paper money that would start coming in 2005, substantial amounts due to tax changes, and allocate it to development of new solar voltaic technology, and instead chose to basically put it out in a number of sort of financial issues that benefited management and ownership, which is, it's very sparsely distributed.
Yeah, you know, and I think they ripped off the California taxpayer to what was that number in 2004 that the Duke Energy Company had pretty much embezzled from the taxpayers of California?
Exactly.
Like 20, I'm trying to remember the number, but it was a big one.
Yeah, and you know, if you take a look at the macro figures or start breaking it down, the accumulation of wealth among the, you know, in the late 80s, it was the top 30% that were doing well. But even if you were up in those echelons, you started getting squeezed until the last 6 or 7 years. Only about the top 2% were doing well.
Right, right. But Mark, you know, I'm up against. You are an amazing caller to have an economist that gets this. Is like we could go on and on and on forever. But are we not talking about my last question? The story of history. It goes in that direction until it topples. You know, it's called a paradigm shift. And then
unfortunately, it usually does, but it doesn't have to.
It doesn't have to. That's,
it doesn't have
that's
to.
Why yeah, I talk, sit that's here that's for 3 hours every day, Mark, and try and talk about it. It doesn't have to be this way. But the haves have louder microphones, and the haves have more power than the have-nots. And so when the have-nots are breaking in the Royal Bank of Scotland, throwing printers through the window, saying abolish money, you know you're at a tipping point, if you will.
Maybe you can carry the flag of, guys, you need each other.
That's what I do say all the time, Mark. That's what I say. That's why I'm here. You summed it up. That's what I do. That's why I have both sides on my program. That's why my number is 1-888-64-NANCY and 1-888-0-NANCY. Because we need to be talking here, okay? We need to be hearing each other. It's not the Amen Club. That's not working out so well, and the ending isn't pretty.
Thank goodness I'm not on any television show tonight. Okay, you get a break. 1-888-64-NANCY. You don't have to set your TV and watch me on Bill O'Reilly. You don't have to turn it over to Fox for a few minutes even to see me. Or whatever. CNN, I'm branching out. It is the Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY. I'm happy that I have a break tonight because I did double hitters, what, show, 3 hour shows, and then these appearances the last couple of nights on the auto industry. This is too funny, though. Nancy, my email is nancy@nancyskinnerlive.com. See, this is why this is so much fun. This was an email I got earlier today. I'm going to read this because the response is even funnier. Nancy, I saw you for the first time in my life on two TV talk shows recently, and all I can say is thank God it took me so long to find you. First of all, if you're trying to out-facial express Nancy Pelosi, heck, I think you win. Pelosi looks like a wind-up comic character with all of her twitching and blinking, but you put Pelosi to shame with your facial expressions. I'm sure you're making yourself make those idiotic, silly, cool facial expressions. Maybe you're trying to look smart, or maybe you're just trying to deflect the audience with facial moves so they won't think about the absolutely crazy crap coming out of your otherwise attractive mouth. I really don't believe that. I don't believe you believe what you say. Nobody is that screwed up. Organic human brains are simply not capable of being wired as defectively as your gray matter seems to be. Spain needs a new female leftist commentator. I'll pay you for your one-way ticket if you promise not to come back. All right, so that was Kenny. And what's funny is Sharon, the webmaster on the Nancy Skinner Show, she is a delight. She writes back to folks. If it's an email like that, Sharon will write nice little messages back. I think you get them automatically. It says, thanks so much for contacting me. If your email requires a response, we'll get back to you soon. Sharon added, hope you're enjoying the show so far. Keep listening. We've got lots more in store, Nancy. And then Kenny writes me back, Nancy, please don't thank me for contacting you, as I have tried hard to insult you as best I can. But feel free to contact me and tell me to take a flying leap, or call me some Jewish slang name, or tell me to kiss your royal Detroit butt. But please don't thank me for anything, as I'm trying to vent my frustrations today on the left-wing loons of America. You definitely included. Regards, Kenny. See? That's what makes me feel, that's what warms my heart up. That's the conversation that we need to have here. We can have this conversation, Kenny. And it's okay. I am going to thank you for your response. You're wrong, but you're funny. And I wrote him back and I just said, why would I do that? You're making me laugh, and that's a good thing. You know what else is making me laugh here in the last couple of minutes? Oh, which one should I choose? The alternative GOP budget made me laugh, gave me a hearty belly laugh this morning.
This is our budget with real policies and real numbers. It gives Americans a real choice for a better pathway forward. I'm going to walk through its components now. Discretionary spending. Our government is already spending way beyond its means. We reject the failed notion that we can spend our way out of every problem. We can't. And we need to get back to setting priorities. So number one, we propose to rescind the Democrats' stimulus package starting in the year 2010, except for unemployment insurance for those who have already lost their jobs. Most of the money in the stimulus package doesn't even spend out until 2011.
Okay, so whatever the prescription is, take it back. Don't take the medicine. That was pretty good. I thought John and I are debating which of these cuts were funnier. John likes tax policy. I thought energy was pretty good.
Energy policy. We reject the president's cap and trade scheme. And we suggest opening our federal areas for drilling and invest the revenue into three parts, a clean energy trust fund, deficit reduction, and the highway trust fund.
Drill, baby, drill. Oh, where have we heard that one before? Okay, that one was pretty good. Hey, you know what else? We've completely neglected Medicaid, because that was pretty funny, too.
We have to start tackling our entitlement crisis. And our budget takes a first step toward that critical reform. And let me walk you through those critical steps. Medicaid. We propose to give states and governors the freedom to tailor their Medicaid programs to meet their unique needs.
So we propose to convert Medicaid into an allotment, adjusting for growth in low-income populations and for inflation. We have so many governors with so many innovative ideas to fix this problem. Let's give them the opportunity to do that.
An allotment. A lottery for people on Medicaid. Did you get that? An allotment? A lottery. Let's take really desperate people in this economy. And instead of just trying to get them through the hump of the break, we'll have a lottery. An allotment was the word he used. We'll let them gamble on whether they can get a chance, maybe, to cure their cancer, their diabetes, preventative medicine, pap smear, mammograms, those kinds of things. That's good. A lottery for the sick and desperate and poor as a result of this economy. Yeah.
I poo-poo.
If it weren't so funny, it would be funny. All right, well, hey, by the way, definitely not going to be on with O'Reilly. That was definitely.
Yeah.
But I'll be back tomorrow, that's for sure, on the Nancy Skinner Show.
One day, December.